Hey friends, it's Michael Nardelli here, and by damn it, I'm starting a podcast. So it's called Late to the Party, and what it's going to be is every week or every podcast, myself or the guest, one of us has to be newly exposed to a classic piece of content, which could be a film, a comic book, a book, TV series, a play, a video game, what have you. One of us, at least, has to be newly exposed to this classic piece of content, and we're going to talk about what made it popular back in the day, why we're still talking about it now, why it's a classic, does it hold up, does it not hold up, and really discussing it in terms of the modern context of our modern lives and what's topical and relevant now, and does it hold up. So, this week, I am newly exposed to Easy Rider, finally, a classic, I know, how did I miss it, directed by Dennis Hopper, and starring Dennis Hopper and Henry Fonda, as well as Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn, and starring Warren Beatty, and Faye Dunaway. And my guest this week is my friend Kyle White. And without further ado, let's start this podcast. So, we have Kyle White, film enthusiast, writer, and also psychedelic enthusiast, which is very apropos for the discussion that we're going to have today on the new podcast, Late to the Party. I'm the first actor to ever decide to do a podcast, so I'm very excited for myself.
This is my first podcast I've ever been on.
Oh, really? Awesome.
Yeah, so thank you.
We're no longer podcast virgins.
No longer podcast virgins.
We're growing up.
Finally.
And we should mention, because God knows, I mean, it might be like 300 years from now when some alien is listening to this on a satellite, that we're doing this in the middle of a pandemic.
Stuck in home.
Global pandemic.
Week five?
Week five. Yeah. Maybe even, because I kind of started my quarantine early, just kind of seeing the writing on the wall. So it might be week six for me.
All right.
Are you going crazy yet?
No, I'm enjoying it. Ironically, I kind of was expecting to go crazy, but I'm an introvert by nature. So what about you? You were more worried about it being a little more like Walking Dead.
Yeah, I'm still worried about that. I don't mind the isolation stuff. I'm mostly fine with that. Although at week six, it is starting to get a little tedious. Like, I'm an introvert, but I'm like, okay, I guess I got a little bit of extrovert in me because I want to do stuff. I want to do stuff.
All right.
I'm getting a little angry, especially now that it's getting warm out too. It's like,
I felt that.
Pour salt in the wound. Anyway, so there's a global pandemic happening. I'm using this time to catch up on some classics that I have not seen. And I mentioned Easy Rider to you, which I have just watched in the last couple weeks. And it seems you are an expert on it, not only on the film, but also the lifestyle that the film preaches. You're into psychedelics, so we should talk about that. But we should also talk about like other counterculture movies, like The Graduate or Five Easy Pieces. And I also just watched Bonnie and Clyde.
What'd you think?
So we can definitely talk about, oh my God, I loved it.
It's great. It was a lot funnier than I thought it was going to be. I remember when I first, Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah. The score made it kind of funnier than, and some of the like supporting characters were Gene Wilder.
Gene Wilder is great.
Yeah, he was great. And I forget the actress's name. She's on Roseanne now. Or was on Roseanne, that plays Gene Hackman's wife in the movie. I forget her. Anyway, she was hilarious. I thought she was awesome. So when did you first see Easy Rider and what does it, when did you first see it and what was your experience the first time you watched it?
The first time I saw Easy Rider was in high school. And I think at that point, My brother was more of a counterculture person by nature than I was. I was more of a nerd. But so he was kind of a film nerd, but he was always drawn to Taxi Driver. He's the one who showed me Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And he showed me Easy Rider, you know, and so I was watching all these films. He also, Paul Thomas Anderson. He always liked stuff that was more out there he did a lot of psychedelics before it was kind of having the new wave that they're having now.
This circa what time?
This would probably be like 2005, 2004. somewhere between 2004 and 2007.
Oh my God. Wait, you were in high school? You were in high school in 2007?
Yeah, I was. And I think I'd seen it before my senior year. I want to say I saw it sophomore, freshman year.
How old are you again? I forget.
I'm 31. I forget too sometimes.
Oh, damn. That seems so, recent, but far. Yeah, I'm older than you.
That's all right. You look younger, so that's all that matters.
No, I don't. And by the time I get out of quarantine, I'm going to look like a caveman. Anyway,
great.
Okay, so you saw it in high school. Your brother
I'm curious, what do you think? Because what was your first reaction to it?
I loved it. It was one of those movies that you do. You ever have like movies where you always know you're gonna watch it someday? Like it's kind of like a title that it's like in your head. You're like, yeah, I'm gonna watch that someday. Someday I'm definitely gonna watch that. Like that's definitely percolating in there. And then you don't really get around to it because new movies come out or whatever. And but I loved it. I obviously started watching it while in quarantine. And I don't know, something about like, I feel like sometimes you watch things at the right time when you're meant to watch them. And there was just something about like the movie and the counterculture vibe and the way it was shot and the indie filmmaking of it all and the open road and the like, you know, late 60s, 70s soundtrack and everything, where it just felt like, yeah, this is the right time to watch this because the world feel like I guess. Well, that's one of the things I want to talk about. Like, you know, is it relevant today to what's going on? Because the whole counterculture movement was about sort of, you know, taking a stand with the way government was involved in our lives and things that were happening in the world and Vietnam and all that stuff. So anyway, that's my long-winded answer way of saying that I loved it. I thought the acting was great, but it was really the filmmaking that I was most impressed with. Dennis Hopper's directing, the way that they shot it, like some of those long shots on the road with the motorcycles, especially in a low budget, like late 60s movie. I mean, I shot one thing on a process trailer in LA and that was a pain in the ass enough. Like I can't even imagine how they shot a whole movie, indie budget, open road like that and made it look as beautiful as they did.
So
I was captivated.
Topper had like a 3-hour, 4-hour cut.
I read about that.
The release, yeah, but
yeah, they lost all the footage or something.
Yeah, they lost all of it.
That sucks.
And thank God it's not 3 hours because I think it's pretty perfect at about 90 minutes.
Yeah, I think it's the right amount of time because it is. You get in, you get a sense of their lives. To me, like the soundtrack made the movie, which I heard. They had to go back and spend another $1 million or so on licensing.
Yeah, to clear all the samples, or not clear the samples, just to get the licensing for the music.
Yeah, I thought about that when I was watching. I was like, this is a killer soundtrack. It must have been so expensive. And it was. So what do you think the movie would have still been as good without all of those needle drops?
No, not at all. Because that's part of that was part of that culture and part of the 60s. So I think you needed... I guess you could have had different artists, different music in it, but it needed to be of that era.
Yeah.
It needed to be Steppenwolf and Bob Dylan cover. I forgot who does that. Did you hear the story of how they cleared that sample?
Something where Bob Dylan didn't want to sing it, so he had somebody else sing it. Is that right?
He talked to him, and we'll get into it later. It had something to do with the LSD scene, but basically he cleared it by showing him the scene where Peter Fonda is talking to the statue of, I think it's Virgin Mary, the statue of Mary in that. And Peter Fonda explained the significance of that scene. And then he let them.
Oh, right. Because he had Dennis Hopper had him say that those lines as if it were to his deceased mother who died when he was, you know, him and Jane Fonda's mother. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did read that. That was crazy. Oh, so that was how we convinced. Okay, got it.
We'll loop back to that because that's a pretty interesting part of the story.
So that was my experience, but now I want to hear about yours because obviously you've sat with the movie. Because the whole point of this podcast is like at least one person on the podcast has to be newly exposed to the classic. It could be a classic book or classic video game, whatever. But one person has to be a noob and kind of look at it from today's perspective and why it's a classic and why we're still talking about it and all that stuff. So you've sat with it for years. I want to hear your take and what it means to you.
Well, what I think is really interesting, I think what makes it at least an interesting look at American history, and this is just my opinion, is the last line that they have. I'm not sure if it's not the exact last line, but when they're finally going to go and they got all the money, and then Peter Fonda, his line to Dennis Hopper is, "We blew it." That's the famous line.
Mm.
And for me, that's kind of interesting as someone who obviously wasn't around in the 60s, but just when I hear my parents were hippies, especially during that era. They were at Monterey Pop, and I think they graduated high school. I want to say they graduated high school in the 70s, so they were in high school during the Summer of Love. And when you listen to everyone else talk about that era, it seemed like that more than any other time, there was a belief that things were going to change and change for the better. I personally never felt that.
About the film or about
I mean about the culture in general.
Like,
you know, I mean, I'm kind of a pessimistic person by nature, so I never really thought like something happens and oh, this is going to change. But so there was that feel that everyone talked about in the 60s, and then now you look back at it, and obviously they go, you know, some of it was very naive.
Yeah,
but there was a feeling that things were going to change, and when Peter Fonda says that line, to me, it is kind of this irony of that things were going to change, and they were going to change because of the hippie movement, and ironically, they didn't change because of the hippie movement. So he kind of has that, like, we blew it, and that's, to me, what the whole film is about, is kind of looking for this new movement that was going to happen in America, and that it didn't happen because of them, and they had a chance to do it. They had a chance to kind of change the world, that, or at least it felt like it. It felt like they did.
Interesting.
And I think Stephen King, he quotes it in one of his books. I think in Hearts of Atlantis, he just quotes, I think that's a book about the 60s. I'm not sure. You'll have to look that up. But that's the opening quote to that book, is just, we blew it. And that's also kind of what that book focuses on as far as themes are concerned.
Interesting. So then I want to talk to you about the irony of, okay, so we blew it. And then also in Bonnie and Clyde, she had a really great exchange with Faye Dunaway, had a great exchange where she said, you know, I forgot what it was. I ran away with you because I thought we were going somewhere, but it turns out this is it, or this is where we're stuck. You know,
yeah.
They're on the run and they're kind of like at the end of their game. So what do you make of, or isn't it ironic or interesting that like these two movies are kind of known now today for having the rebellious counterculture, you know, live free message. I feel like that's the fandom around them. But both of them, I guess, end in a way that is a cautionary tale about counterculture or about, you know, the open road and living free and doing what you want.
Them, though. That's a lot of films in the 70s, which is interesting, is one, the cops are the bad guys.
Yeah.
And two, they always end up at least usually getting them at the end, and it's usually very random.
Yeah, see, the ending to Bonnie and Clyde, it was like, you know, I knew that ending. And it's a true story, the ending to Easy Rider, what do you make of the ending? Because I were, you know, not having been alive at that time, and my parents were not hippies. So I guess, was there that much hatred of the hippie movement and everything that hillbillies are just in their truck killing them with shotguns? Or, spoiler alert.
I think so. I mean, my dad had a couple experiences. You know, he had, what was interesting with my dad, it's, I grew up in Carmel, and they grew up in both Monterey. And my dad has stories about going to, like, backwood places back then and, you know, getting guns pulled on him. He got a gun pulled on him and put to his head. And he was... they ended up becoming dancers, but which was funny was at the time, my dad was actually a jock, but he was like, he had long hair. you know, he was half Japanese, so he, but he actually played football and played basketball. So that, from the stories they tell me, yeah, it was very much like that. And that was in California, so I couldn't imagine being in the South at that time. I do know that Jack Nicholson got the role because Rip Torn felt...
I read about that. Yeah.
You read about that? Okay.
Yeah, that was great. Well, you say it because people watching or listening
so Jack
might not know.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson... Rip Torn was supposed to have Jack Nicholson's role. And when Dennis Hopper was explaining it to him, Rip Torn... He basically... Dennis Hopper was telling him about all these times he had gone on his motorcycle trips through the South and all the troubles he had with rednecks and probably just kind of saying mean things about the South, and Rip Torn was from Texas and he took offense to it. Now, years later, Dennis Hopper, which Dennis Hopper was kind of crazy too, but he said that Rip Torn pulled a knife on him and was threatening to try to kill him, but then Rip Torn sued. He told that story on Jay Leno, and then Rip Torn sued him, so...
It's some of the stories are crazy. Like, I want to get back to the violence, that topic. But I was reading, you probably read this too. It was crazy that they had supposedly had a rap party for the entire production, and then they remembered that they hadn't shot the last scene over with the campfire yet. Did you read about that?
No.
Where, and I watched on the DVD. I have the DVD. They have like the making of it with everybody. It was really interesting. But yeah, apparently they thought they were done and had a rap party, and they're like, oh wait, oh shit, we didn't film the ending. So that's why the motorcycles aren't in that shot, because they had already destroyed them when they...
It's like a very hippie thing to do, so it's befitting for the film.
Well, it's just crazy, and I read that they got baked while they were filming it and everything, and got drunk, I'm sure, too. So it is interesting, like, I mean, you never get away with that now. And it's almost like, should you ever do a movie baked? I guess a lot of people do. I don't know, it seems somewhat irresponsible, but then it turned out they turned out this great movie while they were all clearly inebriated. So who's to say?
Yeah. Well, it was also that, you know, it's a weird thing because it's like drugs played an important part in the 60s, and a lot of people, and even, you know, I think it was John Lennon and even Eric Clapton were basically like, yeah, that's also kind of what ruined it for, that's what kind of ended up ruining it for the hippie movement, was like the drugs got out of control. I mean,
yeah, slippery slope.
It's a slippery slope, very slippery slope.
The gateway drugs.
And yeah, so that was, but yeah.
So, so what was the fear? Like, what was the fear? Why were hillbillies killing hippies? And why were these, you know, backwood, you know, why were they killing them? Why'd they die at the end? Why'd they have to die? Was it just a fear of, like, the culture they were trying to permeate or, you know, bring about, or what?
Well, kind of like Jack Nicholson's monologue in that, when he's telling them that they don't hate them, they hate what they represent, and what they represent is freedom. And he goes, everyone here thinks they're free, but they're not actually free. You guys are free. I think there's part of that. And I just think it was such a, you know, tense time. John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. Think about the race riots. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in 68. Well, when did the Easy Rider come out in 69? So yeah, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. And then you had John F. Kennedy, then you had Lyndon B. Johnson, the Vietnam War after he got assassinated, then you had Nixon and Agnew. And Agnew, I think, Spiro Agnew, the vice president at the time for Nixon, said that Easy Rider was a very dangerous film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Richard Nixon called Timothy Leary was the, professor at... Yeah, he was a professor at Harvard that was kind of famous. Him and Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass, were famous, you know, for giving students LSD. And Nixon had called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America. Mm. So that's, you know, I mean, you got to think about the differences at that time, just where people's consciousness were.
Yeah.
you know, was it, do you support Richard Nixon? Are you against Richard Nixon? I think it was just a tense time.
Yeah. Like now.
Yeah, I was going to say like now.
Like now.
Like it's too, yeah, it seems pretty tense. So.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, I mean, I think that that was always, films from the 70s to me reflected kind of the bleakness and the, some of them at least, the bleakness and what went wrong in the 60s and how it ended. And it just felt like it kind of felt like, okay, they're on this path. They really shouldn't get shot. It's almost like a Deus Ex Machina at a certain point because they're in the clear and then this truck just comes by and, you know, kills them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It almost just drops out of the blue.
Very French. Very French.
Yeah, very, very French new wave.
And so, you know, the end of Bonnie and Clyde, they've obviously committed crimes. They've murdered people. I forget how many people, but more than five, I think. Not more than one is bad enough.
Yeah.
So the ending to that, I guess, was a little, you saw it coming, and it's a true story. You saw it coming, and it was a little bit more like, yeah, the law wins. But in this case, it didn't seem like their lifestyle was obviously different, but it didn't seem like they had done anything. I mean, obviously they sold cocaine and that can lead to problems and health issues, legal, you know,
yeah.
You don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. But it's like the difference, you know what I mean? Like Bonnie and Clyde were out and out criminals. The characters in Easy Rider, did they have it coming? As much? I don't think so.
I mean, I don't think so, but it's kind of a better movie for that because I think it is a reflection of...
Yeah. But what was so fearful about their lifestyle, I guess, for people?
I mean, I think the freedom.
So
that's the whole...
Do you think they were jealous?
Who? Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper?
No. The guys that, you know, the antagonists, if you will, that killed him at the end. Do you think it's a resentment for how
probably.
Free... And it sort of like disrupts the status quo too much, and that's why it scares them.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think you're from Georgia, right?
Sort of. I mean, I'm from Ohio originally, and then spent a lot of time in Georgia, moved around a bunch. But
okay, well, I think it's people just, it's closed-mindedness a little and not being open to, I mean, and yeah, probably feeling threatened.
Mm-hmm.
I would think by that type of lifestyle. Especially if you are, I don't want to say brainwashed, but if you're willing to hold so strong, if you're willing to, you know, white knuckle your opinion to the point where you're not going to let it go, anyone who's going to have a different opinion is going to be seen as a threat.
It's just interesting because I guess I didn't know there was that much antagonism towards the hippie movement and everything. Where they
well,
were
a lot of it
killed.
Too was they were protesting the Vietnam War, not in the film, but just in the culture in general. So that was a huge thing because it was also the first time where major protests had happened against a war in America like that. Because you had the Korean War before that and World War II, and you didn't get that amount. There wasn't a draft in that, but you also didn't get that amount of backlash from the public. So I think that also created. More of more animosity towards people, towards, you know, the hippies and the just kind of the patriots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So,
well, that was new. That was enlightening for me because I didn't, when I got to the, obviously the scene where another character is, well, I mean, people have seen it. That's spoiler, you know, if you haven't seen it. I guess you should have seen it better.
We already talked about
that. But you know, and Jack Nicholson's character. And actually, that's a good point. I wanted to talk about the violence in this movie and in Bonnie and Clyde. There wasn't as much in Easy Rider. But
no, it's more disturbing.
In which one?
In Easy Rider.
In Easy Rider, yeah, because it was more of a shock to the system. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So what do you think it is about... the violence in Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde. I don't know if it was like this for you, but when there was violence in both those movies, I was like, and, you know, I watch a lot of violent things, but a lot of violent movies and games and everything. I'm not really shocked that much anymore. And obviously, you know, these movies are dated a little bit in terms of their effects and prosthetics and everything. So, you know, the blood didn't even look real and at times, and you know, the puncture wounds didn't always look real. But like, why do you think the violence in these two movies was so shocking, especially for a modern day audience member who's kind of seen it all?
I think it's more visceral. They don't cut it as fast. You know, they leave it on it. They leave, because I had that experience watching Taxi Driver. You know, mm-hmm. I'd already seen a bunch of slasher films, and then I remember seeing Taxi Driver when I was in, same thing, in high school or maybe even younger, and kind of being really, really disturbed by the violence in Taxi Driver. And it was like, I was already well acquainted with violence and media by that point. So I think the way it was done, it seems to come out of, with Easy Rider, at least, it comes out of left field because it's really only, like you said, you don't really expect them to get shot at the end, and you don't expect Jack Nicholson to get bludgeoned to death.
No.
You know, and he's such a likable character. So that that makes it way more disturbing too. It's not necessarily a character where you're dropped in a world that you think, all right, everyone here has violence hanging over them. There's a chance anyone in this world could die. You don't necessarily think that when you're watching Easy Rider. You think that when you're watching Bonnie and Clyde, just because the story of it.
Even still, though, that was a shock for me when he shoots the cop or a bank, the first guy that he kills. Like, I know the story of Bonnie and Clyde. I don't know. When I started it, I was like, oh, this is going to be like the 60s version of Natural Born Killers. And I was like, this is going to be like the soft. But I was surprised. I guess I didn't realize or think Bonnie and Clyde were killers. I thought they just robbed banks and got away with it. But I was shocked when he got shot that car passenger, the window. I was like, what? Oh my God. Crazy.
Yeah, I think, who knows what kind of, I don't know what they were using for blanks back then. I think there probably is maybe something with Bonnie and Clyde where it's like, oh, that sounded like a real gunshot to me as opposed to, that sounded like a Hollywood.
Yeah, and go ahead.
Oh, no, so I was going to say there could just be even that stuff, just like the difference between when you see CGI, how your brain always knows that something's off compared to when you see a stunt person, you know, a stunt man or stunt woman do a stunt, you automatically go, because those are what those car chase scenes the car chase scenes in all the 70s movies and Bullet, Vanishing Point, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, Crazy Mary, Dirty Larry, Crazy Mary, and Race with the Devil. All those are all great. Have great chase scenes for anyone who likes car chases. And it's the same thing in that. They don't cut it. And you can see your brain does something where you go, oh,
yeah,
somebody
died
during that stunt.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like when you see,
it's more tactile.
Fast and Furious just cut and everything's cut a certain way. And you can, it's like your brain tells you, oh yeah, we're watching something.
It's more tactile, less polished,
more visceral.
More visceral and lived in, for sure. But I was wondering, do you also think it's because with these movies, they were sort of the pioneers of, I mean, obviously some of them were modeled after French New Wave and Five Easy Pieces and Easy Rider are kind of now thought of as the genesis or the precursor to indie auteur filmmaking and everything. But I was wondering, you know, because part of this podcast is to like examine it from the modern, postmodern point of view, is it because those movies were smack dab in the middle of that transition where it's like they still sort of had the gloss and the nostalgia of classical Hollywood, but they were the first ones to take these steps into sort of more abstract filmmaking or violence in film? Like, I was wondering if that's why I was so shocked, because the opening of Bonnie and Clyde, I was like, oh, okay, this is cute. Not, I was like, this is cute. And I don't know, it had like a Tennessee Williams kind of rhythm to it. And it felt very old, classic Hollywood in some ways. I actually thought the movie was going to be in black and white. I forgot that it was in color. So, and then when it got to blood and puncture wounds and everything, I was like, oh shit. So I don't know. Do you think it's the shocking of that, like kind of the innocent classic Hollywood that was merging at the time with indie auteur French New Wave filmmaking that was more realist and everything?
I think so. I think that was part of it. I think that the themes were probably more mature than what you got from a lot of films from the Hollywood studio system. So I think they challenged audiences a lot more that way. Even like the way that Easy Rider is kind of making us debate right now what it's about, and we're, you know, what, how was, I'm terrible at math, however many years Easy Rider was made. But, you know, you could also say that the term, you know, it ushered in New Hollywood, which is a lofty term. There's no real... It's kind of like film noir, where there's no real definition, but we kind of know what it is when you watch a movie from that era.
It's like anything after Jaws.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, but it's like, yes, there's a really good book called Raging Bulls, Easy Rider, and LSD, and it was all about... It's all about films from that era, and it says Jaws and Star Wars were the turning point because Easy Rider was such a hit that studios figured at that time, okay, these were films made for this culture that they didn't really understand, made by young people for young people, and that they could give them this amount of money and they would actually turn a pretty good profit. And then with Star Wars and Jaws, which are great films, they made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so then
yeah.
kind of went back to being like, whoa, okay, all right, we can make, this is this guy's theory, whoever the author of that book is, which is probably, I mean, it seems like it would be true. And it went back to being like, okay, well, we can now make hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, we're not worried about making $40 million anymore. We can now make a lot of money and reach a much wider audience. But, I mean, Raging Bull was 1980, so that was after that. Scorsese still had films, and Brian De Palma and Paul Schrader still had films in the 80s that were great. But I think even Scorsese had said that by the time they got to the 80s, he was at least privy to the fact that he's like, oh, they're not going to give us the same amount of money the way they used to, and they're not going to give us the same rights or the same, we're not going to have a final cut on our films the way
we
did in the 70s. But so I think it was just challenging themes at that time, because I don't know if I'm repeating myself, but like The Graduate doesn't have any violence. The Graduate's really funny. But I even think you can debate about what the ending means of The Graduate, with Dustin Hoffman sitting there with
after the wedding, right? And they're in the car, the limo,
of the bus. And they sit back, and Simon and Garfunkel starts playing, which to me is melancholy, and their fates go back to neutral. So it's like, you know, did they love each other, or were they just there to save each other from the life that they didn't want? So it was making, it wasn't spoon-fed to you what these films were trying to say. They're open to interpretation, but you also kind of get the feeling and the vibe that they were giving out.
And they all rebuke the happy Hollywood ending. every one of them.
Yeah, that actually became, when you watch films, that became the trendy thing to do for a while. So much that it's almost, at a certain point, it can almost become almost as irritating as a Hollywood happy ending, because you start to be like, okay, well, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And
the other trend of having no ending as your movie.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
is very like French New Wave as well. Just kind of an abrupt, like, boop, we're done.
Yeah, I think it was Quentin Tarantino said Rocky changed that, because Rocky had Rocky has a happy ending. He doesn't win the fight with Apollo Creed, but he goes 12 rounds with Apollo Creed.
Yeah.
And it was like, Quentin Tarantino was like, it was almost as if the time that audiences forgot what it was like to feel good at the end of a film, because it became such a thing to have such a bleak ending that then when they saw Rocky, it was like, oh, that felt nice. You know, I forgot that that was part of it.
That's interesting. I didn't know that quote from Tarantino, and that makes sense because a lot of it, I think, probably his past two, or let's see, Django, Inglourious Basterds, and Once Upon a Time all had, you know, I guess ironically happy endings, or
he always gives, like, happy endings. I think Kill Bill, I think Reservoir Dogs.
Kill Bill,
really
that's true. It's weird to think of him as somebody that gives that. But wait, how did Hateful Eight end?
Hateful
that might
Eight
not have been happy.
More sinister, but it's still happy though, kind of.
It's weird to think of him as a happy ending kind of guy.
Yeah, I think so. I think though that it is, but I think he is, and that's part of the reason he's so popular, too, beyond people who are just film nerds.
Yeah, he definitely breaks out of film nerd and goes into the mainstream somehow. He's one of those rare auteurs that does it, where you're like, you know, I love this movie, and then it's like, oh, my parents will watch this movie, too, you know, even though it's, like, not their typical...
He's also really the only, I would think, one of the only recognizable directors outside of... that people would recognize who aren't film nerds. You know, I have friends who aren't in the movie, and I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if they'd recognize even Spielberg or Scorsese.
You mean by face?
By face. So he's like a celebrity, too, that way.
Interesting. Maybe Jordan Peele at this point, but he was already an actor.
Yeah.
It doesn't count. All right, so, and you know, I have to admit, I've seen other Rocky movies. I haven't seen the first one, so I'm going to have to add that to my...
It's good.
My
it's
list
the
of
only
things.
Thing that sucks is the boxing scenes in it are so corny, but everything else is great.
No, I'm sure I'll love it. Yeah, I've seen all the sequels used to be on HBO growing up, and I've seen all the Rambos, but I haven't seen the first Rocky for some reason, so I got to add that to my list. Okay, so why do you think Easy Rider is still being talked about today? By us, but by other people, it's still very much like in the lexicon. It's a film classic. It's been inducted into Hall
of
Fames.
I mean, it's kind of a punk rock. You know, I think anything that's punk rock is going to be talked about, whether or not it's good or bad. There's always going to have that allure. At least it did for me growing up. And like I said, I was a dork, you know. I was more like Benjamin Braddock in The Graduate than I was like Dennis Hopper or Peter Fonda. You know, that was more my brother's role, but I was a dork, you know. So it's like I really didn't take drugs, and I was a square, but you still have this, you still have a desire to want to see these things that are controversial at the time. You know, some of them you get disappointed by, and some of them you can see why they were popular, but I think there's always going to be that appeal. You know, it's kind of like anything that has that punk rock appeal is going to at least going to appeal to a certain demographic. So it was like growing up in high school, you know, you couldn't get a lot of my friends. I hung out with a lot of skaters and a lot of surfers at the time, and you couldn't get them to read The Great Gatsby, but it was the moment my English teacher would give them Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. You know, they read it in a week. And Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is great writing, but it's like Hunter S. Thompson it's the fact that he's writing about LSD and he's writing about going out and just kind of nihilistically partying. It's going to have an appeal to people that want to do that.
Yep.
You know, I remember reading On the Road, not really getting it, but really wanting to read it because it was like, oh, well, this is this book that, you know, it's about jazz and sex and poetry in the 50s.
Yeah.
That one was, you know, disappointing for me, but it's, and people still talk about that.
Yeah. I read it. I enjoyed it. I read it recently. I enjoyed it.
What's kind of ironic with those two that I specifically brought up is Jack Kerouac and Dennis Hopper is later in life, they were actually became really conservative. And there was...
I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, Jack Kerouac supported the Vietnam War. He didn't like hippies or beatniks. And Dennis Hopper was a Republican. And he died a Republican and supported the Iraq War and George W. Bush.
Interesting.
And there's a lot of theories with Dennis Hopper that, and I've seen this happen with friends that I, with friends and people that I'm close with, is that he was always a rebel, so he was always going to rebel against what was going on at the time. So when he made Easy Rider, you know, it's like you still had John Wayne. They were obviously still declining, but it was like, you know, John Wayne and Jim Stewart, and Hollywood was more Republican at the time.
Yeah.
And then he was really left-winged, and it kind of brought in this new movement. And then once everyone became left-wing, they're like, oh, he just jumped right.
He's always going to be a radical.
Yeah. He just had to go against what was happening at the time.
Interesting. I wonder if that's John Voight's school of thought too. He's sort of like a well-known Republican these days. I wonder, but he was also in a lot of these.
Yeah, John 70s. Milius. Too. I mean, John Milius was always, for anyone who doesn't know, he was a writer director. He wrote and directed Big Wednesday. He wrote Apocalypse Now. Was a writer on Apocalypse Now, and then he's who
didn't he write the original what was it with the like the high school kids that were against that were fighting
Red Dawn? I guess that one tells his political leanings a little more, but he was always famous for being really conservative in Hollywood.
Yeah,
and he's who the Coens based Walter Sobchak off of in The Big Lebowski.
Oh,
and they look identical. I mean, it's my favorite movie, so I'm always obsessed with.
Damn, you got all the knowledge up there. Good Lord.
So I think that there was like, that is interesting to think about, because Dennis Hopper also started out as a studio actor. He was in
Rebel Without a Cause.
And Natalie Wood tried to have a threesome in a bathtub, and they used champagne, and Natalie Wood got in it and then had to be rushed to the hospital right away. But
because,
you know, it's just, yeah, you got to read about it. It's a good story. So never try to have a threesome in a bathtub full of champagne is the lesson.
I got to read about this. That's true.
Totally true. No, definitely true.
What? I got to read. Keep it family friendly. I'm not going to ask.
Yeah.
I guess I can imagine. Okay. So. No, go ahead.
I really think that a lot of the appeal is, I think, has to do with drugs and the fact that its themes are so challenging, because it's kind of one of those things where, when you get into those type of films, at least as a kid, and I really like Hollywood movies, so I'm not a Hollywood hater at all. Like I said, I love Star Wars. It's one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
It is interesting. You know, you kind of grow up and you see these movies. You see the movies that everyone sees, The Lion King and Toy Story and whatever, Forrest Gump. And then you kind of see these movies from the 80s that were famous. My family really liked comedies, so we would watch a lot of Caddyshack and a lot of Mel Brooks films.
Yeah.
And then what's interesting is when you go back and you watch Easy Rider, The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, any of these films, Taxi Driver, it's almost like, oh, whoa, I didn't even know that they were talking about stuff like this back then.
Yeah, or it's like, I can't believe we're still talking about this now, you know,
yeah,
or like the same
or like
issues.
We digressed.
Yeah, well, yeah, sadly.
In certain ways,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I thought that when I started watching Bergman films, that I was like, oh, I didn't know they were making movies that were this challenging in the 50s.
Yeah, yep.
So there's kind of that, and it's like, why wouldn't they be? You know, there's literature and there's plays that date way back before movies were invented that had very challenging themes and themes about existence and pose those kind of questions. But for some reason you get so used to what is popular and what tends to make a lot of money that it's kind of weird to go back and you see that and you go, oh, I didn't know that people were even talking about stuff like this, and that they actually can't even really make, there hasn't really been a movie like this in my lifetime.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's why they persist. I think because unfortunately a lot of those themes and topics, you know, war and poverty and classism and racism and everything are still present today, unfortunately. I just watched this movie, The Hill. Have you seen The Hill? The Sydney movie? I got to look up what year it came out. But I, when I was watching it, was so 1965, surprised at how, obviously racism existed then and was around, but I didn't think they were having that frank of a discussion about it in film at the time. Or I guess I forgot, I haven't, you know, I'm watching, rewatching all these old classic films or seeing them for the first time while I'm stuck at home avoiding Corona. And with that too, I think, like, you know, the idea of like why these movies keep going and going, and we're still talking about them. I was shocked. I was like, wow, they're having the conversations that we're having today in The Hill about racism and all of that stuff. And I don't know. I thought it was, I think what you're saying is right. It's interesting to watch an old movie where you think they were like more naive, innocent times, the way sort of really classic Hollywood films depict lifestyles. And then you're kind of shocked by these very real, mature, graphic discussions that are happening. I think that's why they stick around, some of these.
Yeah, and even really old Hollywood had those movies too. Treasure of Sierra Madre with Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, haven't seen that?
No,
that one's
no.
Great.
Yeah.
So that was, I think it's one of Paul Thomas Anderson's favorite movies. And I at least do know he did watch it and showed everyone showed the whole cast and crew it during There Will Be Blood. But that really actually does.
I have seen that, and I love that.
You have seen that, then you got to see Treasure of Sierra Madre, because I think it's Humphrey Bogart's best role, and which is saying something. That, you know, that deals with the themes of capitalism and greed and and ambition, and even really taking minerals from the earth, kind of raping the earth for profit, because the whole thing's about gold mining in Mexico. So I do think that those films were, I don't necessarily think that it's like, it's totally dead now. I think in one, as you know, it's very hard to make a good movie. We're really cherry picking throughout history right now, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
yep. Yep.
We're picking, like, I would even say, It's a Wonderful Life. You know, I think part of the reason that is so popular is because I think that actually kind of has challenging themes that are different than what you would expect from films of that times, especially.
Yeah.
All About Eve, the same. That one is, that one's great. I mean, that one's just a great script when you read that.
That's on my list. That's moving up my queue very quickly.
That one, you'll enjoy it. It's great.
You may have to come back. Come back to the podcast.
Come back for All About Eve.
Come back to the late party. Yes. Yes.
But I also, did you think Easy Rider was too meandering? Because those were the things when you watch 70s films now.
Once I was like 10 minutes into it, I kind of knew that's where I could see the influence of sort of the French New Wave and the long takes of them on the bikes and the music. No, it didn't bug me. I enjoyed it. I loved it, actually. It sunk in. The whole vibe of it felt really interesting to me, and I wanted to learn more. That's why we're talking about it. I'm trying to think what I was gonna, and the editing I thought was really, I loved the, I don't know what the sort of like, I wrote down, what do we call that editing style where they would do the transitions? It was very psychedelic.
LSD editing.
Shit. Where was it? There was a term for
it.
No,
I never know the technical names of anything.
I might edit this out if I can't find it soon. God, what was it called? Oh, fractal LSD experience.
Fractal. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't know that was the term term for it, but
okay, yeah. So
stay on LSD. So
those transitions were dope. I love them. I was like, what are these? Fractal, is that right? LSD experience.
I call it fractal, but
fractal.
The editing term is I'm just fractal patterns when you're on.
So I haven't done LSD. So talk about.
I haven't either. But I'm a strong.
I thought you had.
I said I'm a psychedelic enthusiast.
What kind of psychedelic enthusiast are you? You haven't even done LSD.
Ironically, I'm more of an enthusiast as far as where it's being pushed right now in culture. Like, I think that's really interesting, I would also say, did you read Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind?
No.
So that was the one that kind of came out recently that I think shifted the pendulum into now where it was now being talked about as something serious. It's a really great book. I would recommend anyone reading it, even if you're not interested in the least bit in psychedelics. It's a very fascinating book. And
what's it called again?
How to Change Your Mind.
How to Change Your Mind.
Yeah, by Michael Pollan. He wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's a journalist and professor of, probably School of Journalism at Berkeley.
Okay.
But he's a cool dude. He's really nice. And he also, it's kind of funny because he also kind of talks about how LSD and the atom bomb were the two things that totally changed the 20th century. And, you know, the you can't really separate hippies from LSD,
mm-hmm.
from the LSD movement. And at the same time, the hippies are kind of the reason that it became illegal again, because it was so misused and abused. And
mm-hmm.
Timothy Leary specifically is one that abused it and then sort of antagonized everyone who was against him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so then it just became kind of this thing that it was like, oh, well, you know, hippies take LSD if you don't like hippies. But actually what is interesting is before that, in the 50s, it was really seen as the next breakthrough and by mainstream psychologists. There was some...
I read about Cary Grant, how he experimented with it, and...
Yeah, I said it cured his depression.
Yeah, there was a lot of... experimentation with LSD for depression and for mental illness and things like that I read about. That sounded really interesting. It made me want to try it, but I think I'm too scared to.
Want to do it with...
It's also illegal.
So yeah, you don't want to do it like they did with any Easy Rider.
I was going to ask you, so did you feel like... I know you haven't done LSD. Did you feel like... I'm guessing you've done other psychedelic substances that grow and shit. I'm guessing. And did you feel the trip in the third act?
I think they were really tripping and they filmed him. And so when he was crying about his mom, Peter Fonda's mom killed herself by committing suicide when he was 10 in a really fucked up way. She cut her throat with a razor. And, that scene for me just makes my stomach knot. Just makes my stomach in a knot, because I think anyone who's been in a situation like that goes, that is not fun.
The
definition of not fun and the definition of not cool. So it's for me just going,
it hurts. It cuts deep. Because I mean, I even, you know, like, and I actually want to get to this topic of marijuana and use and everything. It's legal in California now, so I don't mind saying. Yeah, sometimes even like smoking pot will give me a lot of anxiety and a lot of paranoia. Not to the extent that he had it in the movie, but I recognized the feeling of, you're like, oh crap, I'm on a substance and it's going to last for, you know, a little while, you know?
Yeah, well, sometimes the trippy thing with the other stuff is you go, am I on a substance or... Is, you know, I mean, you kind of are like,
yeah, it's,
you can flirt with insanity. You know, when you see a crazy person on the street yelling, you know, and acting angry, it's like, okay, well, I feel like I've been there before in my life. and that is a scary place to be. So
did you feel like the movie represented it well? And how do you think the movie in its presentation and everything reflected a lot of drug use?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more, like I said, I actually think it's more of a reflection of where they went wrong with it in a certain way that was like, oh, well, this was all irresponsible. And this is where they blew it, to quote the movie, is by stuff like this, where it was that had a pretty big impact on shifting the consciousness at the time. And they abused it, as all good Americans are good at doing. They're good at abusing anything. So it's like, I think that, and there's also, there is, you know, it's, I think their characters, for the most part, are likable in the film. But there's obviously going to be people who wouldn't agree with that and wouldn't like them. So I think it kind of shows sort of like, it's almost as if they make the, they attack the opposing side so much in Easy Rider that anyone who's remotely like a redneck, they're going to watch the film and be like, well, shit, I ain't ever doing that. You know, that's some hippie shit. So it's they kind of did their own job antagonizing everyone else who also had a different opinion than them. It's this weird, sort of this weird irony.
Yeah.
It's like, well, hippies didn't necessarily accept people who weren't hippies at the time, but...
Yeah, no, that's true. And that's definitely something that's continued on to today.
Kind of just gets more and more divided.
Yeah, people cling to their point of view. The movie was obviously told from the point of view of hippies.
And from what I hear, LSD can make you really second guess that. So I think that's important at this time.
Second guess what? Your
opinion. I mean, you experience ego death, you know, which is the disillusion of yourself. And so when you do that, all of a sudden, someone who you think is being very different to you all of a sudden doesn't seem that different anymore.
Yeah.
There's no self, there's no I. So I think that, so I actually think it's kind of a good warning sign in a weird way.
What is?
Easy Rider, the movie, far as like, this is what went wrong. This is, you know, why this is what went wrong at the time. And hopefully... we could learn our lesson, because it's not going to work out this way. You know, you can't just get money and find freedom. You can't, you know, it's would be nice if you could, but it just doesn't work out like that.
Yeah. So where do you think the survivors of that movement, what do you think the survivors of that movement are now? Is it Burning Man? Is that it? Is that the only
from that? No,
well, yeah, just like what, you know, what, the lifestyle that they were trying to harness in that movie, obviously.
I think they're like Dennis Hopper. They all probably got, I mean, I experienced grew up in Carmel, and Carmel's interesting because it's, I don't think it has as much anymore, but it's conservative. But then there's also echoes of the hippie movement just by being in Big Sur. Now I think it's just, I kind of got the last of it, but at least a lot of my friends' parents were hippies. My parents were hippies. And then it's like, what I saw, what happened with that, I'm being very general right now. And so I'm sorry if you're listening and you disagree with me, but at least in my experience it's like they kind of got jaded because there probably was a belief that something was going to change and then it didn't. You know, it's like, during, I think it was the 2016 election, there was someone older who came in and everyone was talking about it as it was starting to get closer to the election. And he looked at me and he was like, I've been alive a long time, seen a lot of presidents come and go. Ain't none of them do shit that I ever noticed. And he walked away and I was like, he does have life experience. So they got jaded. And then it's weird because then it's like, I mean, I think just as far as movies go, it's like and music, this is actually pretty interesting too, is it's like so good, and then cocaine comes around in the 80s, and in my opinion, it just goes, whoa, yeah, this just tanked in quality. Because I, when I was getting into movies, I was watching movies for, I'm not an encyclopedia in films, but I'm
pretty close, it seems.
Thank you, but not like the, I watch movies from every era to study them, and
yeah.
I listen to a lot of lots of different types of music too, and it is kind of like, you can understand why each era, the appeal to each era, if that makes sense. Like,
mm-hmm.
you can understand, like, oh, this was cool in the 70s. I get disco. Interesting thing, side note with disco music is I kind of feel like it was the same thing what I was saying about Rocky. I had heard someone else compare that to why disco got popular in the 70s, because they were like, oh, yeah, people had forgot that music was supposed to be fun and to dance to. It wasn't, didn't always have to be Bob Dylan and...
Yeah, yeah.
Really serious rock concerts that people, there's also, and so the dude who, my girlfriend was telling me, who opened Studio 54 was saying that, but he's like, people had forgot that you could just go out and dance.
Dance and have fun and let your hair down.
Yeah, but I do think what's interesting is when you get to movies in the 80s, it is kind of the time where there are great, great, great movies from the 80s, but things got weird. Reagan was president. A lot of cocaine happening at the time.
90s
so,
were a weird time, too, for movies.
I feel like it was kind of... Well, I feel like Quentin Tarantino kind of brought back a little bit the counterculture movement. I mean,
yeah.
I think that that was
And some David Lynch in there, too.
For American films. For American films.
For indie films, yeah.
Yeah.
But so, where are the... The hippies, not where the hippies today, but where are the, what's the right way to phrase it? These characters, not that they're still alive today, but where would they be today? Are they Bernie Sanders supporters? Are they, you know, old guys at Burning Man, you know, using Burning Man? Because Burning Man is the counterculture Mecca, I guess.
I've never been.
I've been, right? Twice, yeah. And I'm not, you know, I wouldn't call myself a hippie.
It's a total different time. It's
yeah.
Different era,
yeah.
You know, for, I think, for better, I actually think for the most part for better, because I think some of the naiveness has gone away. You know, I think, just even if you look at someone, or at least in my opinion, you know, Bernie Sanders seems like his heart was definitely in the right place.
Yeah, but same kind of dream, not the same kind of dream is, but a vision of something being different than it is.
Yeah,
you
just
know,
different.
And
yeah.
Both times he hasn't gotten the so I think that's what made me think of him, as you said, sort of like the hippie dream, you know, didn't wind up as what they thought, what they wanted it to be.
Well, that was also a huge movement of the time. You
yeah.
know, that was, I haven't seen, it's just, it's a totally different world now.
Yeah.
Internet, I think, is kind of what we're dealing with now as far as how drastically that changed the world, you know, for better and for worse.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a total different era. You know, it's like asking where the flappers are now, or, you know, it's like, oh, well, that was of that time. You know, there's little niche people that are going to love Hemingway and Fitzgerald and jazz music. And
the flappers now are hipsters in Silver Lake.
That's yuppies. Exactly. So
more or less, or the coffee shop
or the coffee
that we
shop.
Know. Yeah.
So I think, I think it's totally different now.
Yeah.
I also wasn't alive back then. I don't think so, at least.
And you might have been reincarnated. We don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe. So, and then another thing I was thinking about while I was watching this is I'm now watching it in a period where marijuana is totally illegal.
Yeah.
And not really that big of a deal anymore, like the mystique about it.
Yeah.
So, like, what do you think if marijuana had been... I felt like watching this, a lot of the rebellious spirit, the kind of like screw you in your face to the establishment was was like manifested in their dope smoking. You know, like that was the like, yeah, I'm getting high on dope. And yeah. So do you think, how would that look, or what would that be if it was legal? Would it be as cool? Would they be as cool now?
No, I've thought about this before because I love stoner comedies, and I don't think they have quite the same appeal anymore because it's too, you
Isn't
know,
that funny?
Like different. Yeah, and I think that's what, for in a good way, if it's done responsibly, I think that's what could happen with something like LSD, you know, if that actually, well, LSD probably won't because there's too much cultural baggage, but psilocybin, MDMA, assisted therapy, if people really do have breakthroughs with that, and then it becomes kind of this accepted throughout our culture that that is something that you do to battle mental illness or depression, then mm-hmm. I think, yeah, then it's going to lose its appeal. It's not going to be as funny. I mean, it'll still be kind of funny. You know, stoners are still going to be kind of, you can still have that trope in films, but it does lose its appeal a little bit.
Yeah, it's just funny, like, the, you know, growing up when I was in high school, marijuana was not, pot was not legal where I was. And it still had that rebellious, yeah, you know, we're cool and we're doing this and it's illegal, but it's, you know, almost.
Yeah, I mean, I had friends' parents, you know, call them that I grew up with that were really conservative. And then it was like the second it became legal, their friends were, you know, probably like Trump supporters, and they were calling them, asking them what pot to buy. You know, so
yeah.
Like, I mean, it's so weird because people are so brainwashed and so inundated by their culture, by their politics, by religion, by whatever it is that you grew up with. You know, it's like you can become so inundated and affected by that that you really can't ever move away from that. You know, so it's like,
yeah.
But then to the point where it's like, oh, now all of a sudden the government says that it's fine.
It's
so
funny though how it loses
yeah,
its loses its
my
sexiness though by being legal.
It's not going to be. I mean, it's not going to be. LSD is not going to be as cool when, you know, people's moms are going to therapy. I think it'll be a lot more effective. I think it'll be great and a lot better. But yeah, of course, it does lose its edginess.
And you think that'll happen? You think LSD will?
No, I don't think LSD will. Sorry, excuse me, psilocybin.
So, like, microdosing mushrooms and stuff like that for therapeutic reasons. I know people that do that.
I think going to therapy and having psilocybin, there could be microdosing too. I'm not sure as what the legalities are right now on that. It was in phase 1 or phase 3, but the closest that it's that it can be to becoming legal. And a big part of that was just because all the soldiers with post-traumatic were coming back with PTSD. Were having such good, the benefits were so good that the Army backed it. So that was a huge.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, that was a huge, huge victory.
So do you think that's coming?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean,
okay.
I think it should be.
Yeah.
Coming here, we could use it.
Hey, it's from the ground, you know? Like, I feel like if it's from the ground and
I think Easy Rider, though, where it's rebellious spirit, it's still going to have that, even if pot doesn't seem like it's as rebellious now. The idea of, you know, saying fuck it all and riding your motorcycle across country and not wanting to sort of live the type of life that everyone says you should live, that's always going to happen.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I wanted to ask you about that then. So coming at, you know, have we talked about why it's still relevant and why it's classic and people are revisiting it or visiting it for the first time, like me. So as we are moving through the pandemic and we have a big election coming up, what parallels, well, we've already talked about that a little bit, but do you think there could be some other kind of counterculture movement or some other, I don't know. What do you think the world's going to look like as we come out of the pandemic and as we go into another election cycle and everything else that's going on? Do you think you know, there's going to be two guys back on their bikes blowing through the desert, selling coke, and, you know.
I want to hear your opinion after this. What do I think, though? I think it's, It's interesting, because on one hand, I think we're seeing, this is, once again, this is just an opinion, and I would never ever claim to know exactly what I, never ever claim to be right, and I'd, you know, always be a little worried if anyone listened to my opinion, but it's tricky, because it's like, on one hand, we're seeing a lot of progress, and in ways people are accepting people that are different. I think better treatment of women mm-hmm. is happening, you know, and that's a great thing. And we're also seeing the rapid rise of technology.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a weird, you know, it's a weird thing is I don't necessarily think, technology, it's almost like the whole world went into her cell phone. Which
mm-hmm. yeah.
I think is interesting because it's like, oh, well, that's kind of where the new art is going. So much that I love movies as a storytelling medium, but, you know, a realistic part of me goes, I don't, are they going to make it? You know, will there be movie? I think there will be because it's making money, because they can still make money, but it's
yeah.
with streaming and the way things are
and
now.
And Quibi.
It's, what's up?
Quibi, the new streaming thing where you can watch, you know, 10-minute segments, you know, on your car, you know, train ride or whatever.
Yeah, so it's weird, you know, because in one way we're making progress, and then in other ways it feels like we're heading right into a Philip K. Dick story, or, you know, heading into the Matrix, and that, I don't know, what do you think?
Well, we're certainly heading into Contagion.
Yeah.
When we're in the middle of it. I think that there will, the experience of the pandemic, and everything that's already been going on politically is definitely going to change. Like, when we get out of this, things are going to be different, I think. I mean, obviously people are going to have to keep practicing social distancing, and there's going to be a general, I mean, I already have it because I'm a germaphobe and hypochondriac, but now people are going to be living in my shoes. There's going to be a disease for a while. Like, people are going to be nervous and paranoid for a while. And then I just think, you know, the younger generation coming up will have gone through two recessions within, 12 to 15 year period. So that's a lot for a generation to take on. And then technology, which I think is the biggest, I think it's going to be a big problem, for sure. People's attention spans and, the way that it's like, you know, kind of changing our brains. And I mean, I find it a lot now, like I can't remember things. I have to look it up on Google, stuff that I would have totally remembered like 10 years ago. So I think that's going to be a big problem. And even just carrying a phone around all day, I often think like our phones, the new cigarettes, where like 20 years from now, we're going to all, I don't want to say it. It's concerning, but so I do think, you know, the guys in the story that we learned through these characters, I do think there's going to be similar counterculture reactions to, I mean, politically. And then I think as a result of the pandemic, I think things are going to look different when we get out of it, for sure.
Yeah, I think that there will be too. I don't know if we'll see it in our lifetime, if we'll see like another hippie movement or a big, basically it was, you know, oh shit.
Ruh-roh.
Uh-oh. I disappeared.
Gotta go? Oh, I still see you.
Wait, I do? You do?
I do, yeah.
Seeing you. Hang on. What is this? All right, well, I can't see you anymore.
Okay.
I don't know why.
I know. I haven't figured out Zoom yet either. I'm always pushing stuff, and then people disappear, and then they come back. I see you. So,
all right. Well, I'll just talk to my screen.
Talk to yourself.
I'm looking at you. Yeah, I mean, that was like where, I don't know, it's hard to tell if there will ever be a big pushback against the older generation. Or it could be, you know, who knows what that pushback will be, you know? It's like I had friends growing up who it's like their parents were hippies and the way they rebelled is they wanted to play football. You know, and that was like a nightmare for the parents.
Yeah.
So it could be that too. You never know.
I don't know though. Just like, you know, I have friends that have children that it's like their senior year and they're not even getting to live out their normal senior year now because school's canceled. And then you see kids in these masks and you're like, what are these kids going to think about this when they get older? Like, did we fail to protect them and everything? And I do this thing, like people have been holed up in their houses for over a month now. I do think there's going to be an immediate, as soon as it's feasible, like people are going to want to see each other again. So maybe that'll be a good thing. Of like, you know, it could be good in the sense of, you know, we've been overly reliant on technology for the last however many years, decade. And, you know, now some people like me, I live alone. So all I have is my computer and my phone to communicate to people. But it's definitely, and I'm an introvert, but I'm definitely feeling like, ooh, I want to get out and see people, you know? So it could be good.
I mean, I think that there will, you know, I hope that there's some positivity that comes from this entire situation.
Yeah. Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything else you want to say about the film, your experience with it?
No, can't think of anything. Thanks for talking.
Psychedelics. No, this was great. Thanks for doing it. This was fun. Yeah. I learned a lot,
too. This was fun. I could keep on going, so this was a lot of fun.
Well, that's the whole point is, like, one, to keep my film school education going. You know, also, we're in a pandemic, so I have time to revisit some of this stuff. But,
what are you watching next?
But it's just fun to, like, because, you know, I missed the boat on this to have, like, a water cooler discussion about Easy Rider, you know? I wasn't born in the 60s, so now we get to do it now. Let's see. Next. I have a bunch of, there's a film called Yi Yi that I want to watch. Have you seen that?
No.
I watched, Roger Rabbit with my brother last night, but I've seen that a million times.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going back to some of the true nostalgia during this too. We watched Bill and Ted's, both of them. That was fun. Speaking of stoner comedies. What's my next? I don't know. The Wire. I've started watching The Wire.
Okay.
I had seen season one a while ago, and then I just got distracted and didn't finish it. So I'm rewatching season one, and then I'm watching all of The Wire. So that'll be my next.
You got a lot of good stuff, then.
I've been trying to tackle The Wire for a while. That's one of those that's definitely been like, damn, I should watch that today, but no, I'm.
It's daunting. It's because they're so, I don't know, I feel like getting into old shows. I actually haven't seen The Wire, but I know I have friends who it's their favorite show.
Well, they're so revered, too. You want to be in the right headspace. Like, when I watch something that's classic, I want to make sure I'm watching it mind, body, spirit, you know?
Yeah. Like, it's easy, too, to commit. Like, Easy Rider, you might have to mentally get yourself to sit down and watch it. But then it's 90 minutes, and it's an easy, for the most part, like, it's a very watchable 90 minutes. But Wire, how many hours is The Wire?
Hundred? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, 100 episodes, you know,
that's why I'm kind of excited. I think there might be a shift back towards film, because now there's so many series coming out. That I don't think, and they're all good. A lot of them are good. Most of them are good, but like people don't have time.
They're too good. That's the problem.
They're too good. People don't have time to invest themselves into all these things. So I feel like there's going to be a shift backwards film. A good 2 hour.
Yeah, I hope so.
2 hour journey in and out.
Yeah, I hope so.
I hope so too. I think so. I don't know that they're going to be in theaters.
I hope they are.
But I hope they are. I'm excited for Tenet. Tenet. I heard that they're sticking to the July release for Tenet.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what all these movies are going to... That'll be... I mean, that makes sense that they stuck with that. But there's a lot of ones that... Now it's going to be like a clusterfuck of films, I feel like, next once they reopen theaters again.
That'll be
because
nice.
Because I think they're gonna be skeptical on reopening theaters, because there's gonna be that thing of what you're saying is like, are people going to want to go out to see movies? Because that's like, you're sitting close with people, and then if they don't let them do that, then it's like they're not selling as many tickets.
Well, here's what I think he's gonna do with Tenet is like, stick to that. Everybody else has canceled their release, and I read the article in IndieWire today that he's really adamant about that coming out in theaters and sticking to the July release date. And I think they'll do it, and it's just going to be the only movie out for months, kind of like back when Gone with the Wind came out, and it was the only movie in theater for like a year. And I think that's going to happen with Tenet. It's going to be the only new big movie in theaters. And so even though we'll be, auditoriums will be socially distanced, so you have fewer people in them, it'll dominate all the screens, and it'll be, you know, the only new. So I think it's going to be awesome. I think he's totally going to do it.
I hope so.
I think he's going to pull it off. Yeah, and it's going to be a historical thing, because he's the type of director that would do that.
Yeah, he's a good
the mythology of it,
to
the
have leading,
legacy.
To having leading that movement, too.
Yeah.
He's so adamant about showing on film. And
I hope so. I hope so. It happens. God knows I want to go back to the theater.
Me too.
Good Lord. All right. Well, Kyle, thank you so much for doing this. And
thank you.
Let's do it again sometime. And
definitely, please. That was a lot of fun.
And protect yourself.
You too.
Wear
Stay
a mask.
Safe.
Wear gloves.
FaceTime someone you love.
FaceTime someone you love and watch good movies and stuff.
All right, dude. Thank you.
All right, sir. Be well.
Talk to you soon.
Over and out. End of podcast number one.
Beautiful.
It's exciting.
Thanks, man.
Bye-bye.